Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, if you like this podcast or any of the other things that 1517 does, you can become a contributor. You can donate so that we can keep doing that. So there's a donate page. You can sign up for a one-time gift or a reoccurring gift. If you're willing and able to do that, we would appreciate it. Chad, we left off in an interesting spot where David has a sweet deal set before him. The commander of the king's army is going to hand him the kingdom. This is a great chance for David to put all the jewels in his crown, as it were, with minimal bloodshed. Problem is that the guy that's offering this deal also happened to kill the commander of his army's brother, and he is not into this arrangement at all. And so he tricks him into having a little powwow with him and then, you know, murders him in cold blood. And David is very upset about this. He wants everyone to know this was not his idea and he had nothing to do with it. And one of the ways to, I think, to show this, now we talked about how it's shocking. And if Joab wasn't his nephew, that there's probably no chance that he survives this. The example that would be made would probably be legendary. But David still has to take some steps to make it clear that he does not approve of this and that he thinks this is a very bad thing.
Yeah, so we're in 2 Samuel 3:31, and the way it starts out makes it pretty obvious that he's going to more or less make a public example out of Joab. He's not going to kill him, of course, but he is going to make a public example out of him, You kind of get the impression this is going to be almost a shaming of Joab.
Yeah.
So he's taking this guy out. Joab's killed Abner, and everybody knows it. So what does David do? This is verse 31. David said to Joab and to all the people who were with him, tear your clothes and put on sackcloth and lament before Abner. The very guy who took him out, who took Abner out, is now going to be forced to mourn his death. I mean, the irony here is pretty thick. And that's what happens. So it's not just David, not just Joab, but all these people, they tear their clothes, which of course was a pretty typical, but maybe there was some kind of public crying out because of this death. And then David stations himself behind the bier, behind literally the bed, but the device or the thing upon which they were carrying the body. Interesting little detail here too that we can't just rush past. It says, and King David walked behind the bier. And this is the first time that we have reference to this kind of construction. So David's been called king before, and we've known that for a long time, but he's not been called King David. He's not been called Hamelech David in Hebrew until this particular verse. And this is going to recur two or three other times. And we'll see through actually the rest of this chapter that the narrator seems to be at pains to point out the fact that David is king. He's going to be called king time and time again throughout the rest of this chapter. But here he's called King David, which is a way of making very explicit that no matter what's happening in the north, no matter what's happening with Ish-bosheth, who is the supposed king over the northern tribes, the true king is the one who is mourning the death of Abner. So David walks behind the bier, and they take Abner's body to Hebron, which is where the murder took place. They take him to Hebron. The king, we're told, lifts up his voice, and he weeps at the grave of Abner, and all the people who were with him wept as well. And then we have a lament. Of course, in chapter 1 of 2 Samuel, we have the reported death of Saul. And if you remember that whole story, the Amalekite comes. He claims to have finished off Saul. And then David has the Amalekite killed, executed, because he said that he killed the Lord's anointed. And then David chants this long lament about the death of not only Saul, but also of Jonathan, a very moving, powerful lament that we talked about. Now David's going to chant another lament over Abner, which is a little surprising. I mean, you could understand him chanting a lament over someone who was part of his own army, maybe a family member, someone who was really close to him. But not Abner. But I think David is sincerely stricken because of this unjust killing. But at the same time, he also wants to put as much distance as possible between himself and the perpetrator of the crime. Nobody thinks he ordered Joab to do this, in other words.
Yeah, well, David is the king, and he is also the king of two things being true at the same time, right? And it seems to me that David is upset about this, and that he has to make a political statement about this as well. So it is in David's political interest to mourn the death of Abner, to make a public display of it. And I don't think it's only that. I do think that he's upset about it. And not just because something that was going to be easy just became much more difficult. Not just because of that, but when we're about to get into the lament, but it seems to me that David, as a warrior, is upset that Abner, who was also a warrior, was killed in this way. And so there's this sort of shameful, this death is not a death that he thinks is befitting someone like Abner. So even though he was the commander of an army that was for a while in opposition to him, it seems to me that there's a warrior respect there, and David thinks that Abner deserved better than this.
Yeah, you know, that is a great point to make. There's sort of a warrior ethos that you can pick up in this language that's used. And at the same time, I mean, it is a lament over his death, but at the same time, the language is clearly an indictment of Joab. So he's, again, doing both things at the same time. The lament's pretty short. I'll just read it so everyone can get a feel for the language. So this verse 33, should Abner die as a fool dies? Your hands were not bound, your feet were not fettered. As one falls before the wicked, you have fallen. And then it says all the people wept over him again. So that the Hebrew word for fool there, should Abner die as a fool dies, that's a word that we know from back in 1 Samuel. The husband of Abigail, Nabal or Naval, his name means fool. So should Abner die as a fool dies? In other words, should he die in a way that would be befitting someone who is like Nabal, Abigail's deceased husband?
Yeah, and into this is the answer no, right?
I mean, it's a rhetorical question.
Yes, what it's suggesting is that no, he should not have, right?
No, he should not have. Yeah, he says, you know, you were never captured. That's what this language, I think, is intended to convey. You were never captured. So your hands weren't bound. Your feet were not put in fetters. You were not like a prisoner of war because, of course, you were a valiant warrior. Everybody knew that. Ishbosheth in the north was scared to death of Abner because Abner was so powerful. He was such a great warrior. And we saw that in action. He didn't want to kill the brother of Joab, but he wouldn't turn back. So he ends up killing him. And of course, they have the whole battle scene as a result of that.
And Abner's a great warrior. It seems that Joab is too afraid to fight Abner one-on-one. I mean, he had to do this in a very cowardly way.
Yeah. Yeah. So Abner, no doubt, was one of the greatest warriors that Israel saw during this time period. And so David laments his death, saying, "Hey, you know, your hands were not bound, your feet were not put in fetters. As one falls before literally the sons of wickedness, so you have fallen." And that's that indictment that I mentioned: as one falls before these sons of wickedness. So by saying that, David is basically describing his nephew, really his nephews, because they paired up to do this, his nephews, as sons of wickedness. So he's doing everything he can to, besides actually executing Joab, he's doing everything he can to distance himself from their wicked actions, both in his actions of publicly mourning and lamenting, and then in his lament that he chants over the dead body. And he's not done yet. Verse 35 says that everybody comes to David to try and get him to eat something while it was still day, but David wouldn't do it. In fact, he swore a vow. He said, "May God do so to me and more also if I taste bread or anything else before the sun goes down." So, you know, you keep track of everything. He's torn his clothes. He's put on sackcloth. He walks behind the coffin. He chants a lament. Now he's fasting. I don't think there's anything else he could have done short of executing Joab to make it clear that he didn't want this. He didn't ask for this. He wanted Abner to actually come over to his side, because that would have been better for everybody. So verse 36 says, kind of an odd verse. It says, all the people took note of it. That is, took note of David fasting, and it pleased them. And then here's what kind of struck me, this last phrase, just as everything the king did pleased all the people. We do kind of get that impression, like, you know, we've talked about this multiple times, how David can't seem to do anything wrong. You're like, you know, everybody just crazy over David. Everybody loves David. David always gets his way. And you have that almost summarized in these words. Everything the king did pleased all the people. Everybody was, you know, his approval rating was 100%. That's David for you.
Yeah, and it's letting you know that this two things being true at the same time is working. So David feels that Abner was dishonored in his death. He's not happy about it. And he also knows that I have to do something that will make the people... Because no doubt a lot of people were upset about this as well. I mean, Abner was a guy of great influence, as we talked about. He's the guy that it seems that most the people really trusted, at least the supporters of Saul. He was the guy that it wasn't Saul's son that they trusted. It was Abner. And so David knows he has to do something to show that he also is upset, that he likewise is grieving the loss of Abner. And of course, because David is David, it works. And because most of the things David does work.
Yeah, and we have made explicit what we have been talking about all along in verse 37. All the people and all Israel, now that's important, not just David's people, but all Israel. So the other tribes who were not yet under David, they too understood that day that it had not been the will of the king to put Abner, the son of Ner, to death. And then the chapter finishes up with a couple of verses of David talking to his servants. He says, do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? And I was, well, you can translate this two different ways. The ESV has, I am gentle today. The New American Standard has, I am weak today. The Hebrew word is rock, and it can really mean either one of those, gentle or weak, just depending on the context. And then he describes... So he describes himself thusly, and then he goes on to say that these guys, that is his nephews, the sons of Zechariah, are either too difficult or too severe for me. So however you want to translate that, he's basically setting up a contrast. Here am I, I'm rock, that is to say I'm weak or I'm gentle, I'm acting in this sort of way. And the implication is that I am basically being oppressed by my own nephews. They're creating a hard, difficult situation for me because they themselves are difficult or they themselves are severe. In other words, I'm trying to act in a way that's going to be good for Israel, that's going to bring the country together, that is just, that is right, that is best for everyone. And yet they are continually tripping me up and making it harder for me to actually do what God has called me to do. And then he finishes out by saying, may the Lord repay the evildoer according to his wickedness. Now, that might strike us as like kind of vengeful, but it's actually the exact opposite. He's saying, listen, I'm not going to be the one who takes revenge. I'm going to put this in the hands of God. So may the Lord repay the evildoer according to his evil. In other words, I'm going to let God be the judge. I'm going to let God take care of this situation instead of doing it myself. Now, could David have executed Joab? I suppose he could have. I mean, he is the king, so it doesn't seem to be anything that would have stopped him from doing that. But for whatever reason, he chooses not to. And instead, in this case, he is going to more or less say, you know, vengeance is mine, I shall repay, says the Lord. So I'm going to let God take care of that act of justice when the time comes.
Yeah, and this statement that's made to his servants is one of the reasons you know that this isn't all just it's not all performative. You know, it's not all theater, because this is not, he's not saying this to everybody. He's saying to his servants who don't, it almost seems like it's implied that they're not mourning the way they ought to, or that they think this is all theater. I don't know, but as he says to them, do you not know that a prince, and that's an interesting way to refer to Abner, right? Not a prince, but he says a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel. So David does not think that they are acting accordingly, and he is saying this again, not publicly. He's just saying this to certain people, which lets you know that while this is a wise political move, that David does actually feel this way.
Yeah, I mean, one can certainly get the impression that he's just kind of being the politician, but it's far more than that. I mean, David certainly does make political decisions, but at the same time, those are, at least some of them, or maybe most of them, are motivated by a desire for truth and justice and for what's going to be best for the nation as a whole. But he's not finished with issues dealing with people, because we're about to have another problem, and that's what we're going to encounter in chapter 4. After the death of Saul, his son Ish-bosheth has taken over, and of course Abner was his strong man. Abner's gone, so now that understandably puts Ish-bosheth in a very vulnerable position. He was not a great warrior. He kind of relied on Abner to be the one who was the warrior, the one that everyone would listen to, the one who was going to basically defend his throne. Well, now that Abner's dead, what's going to happen to this guy? Well, we find out in chapter 4 that what happens to him is one more kind of shameful death, we might say. It's really an assassination is what happens to him. So it starts out chapter 4 this way. It says, now when Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, heard Abner had died in Hebron, he lost courage, or his courage failed, and Israel was disturbed. The Hebrew idiom there is connected to the hands, so his hands grew weak is the way it's expressed. And so in Hebrew, the hands are understood to be almost symbolic, we might say, of power, of strength. So when your hands grow limp or your hands grow weak, that means that you've lost your courage. So at the closest English idiom might be something like he lost his grip, something like that. But I mean, you get the point. This, even though he was scared of Abner, he's even more scared now, because at the death of Abner, he realizes I've lost my wall of protection around me because of this. And then we're kind of told where he's at. And then we are introduced to two characters who are to become central to the rest of this chapter. Said Saul's son, that is Ish-bosheth, had two men who were commanders of his bands, his raiding bands. And the name of the one guy was Baanah, and the name of the other was Rechav. They were the sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, of the sons of Benjamin. So just to kind of try and get all this together. So you may remember from way back in the book of Joshua, that you had the various tribes settling here and there, and they were taking over, of course, parts of the Holy Land. And so you had everything divided up. And you also had certain tribes who were already living there, like the Gibeonites, who were more or less kind of subsumed into some of these tribes. So that's kind of what's going on here with these guys. They're not native Israelites, in other words, but they were sort of what we might call naturalized Benjaminites. So not Israelites, but they became part of the tribe of Benjamin. So much so, in fact, that they were leaders. They were military leaders of these marauding bands that would go out. So we have their two names. They're called Baanah and Rechav. Well, what do? Well, we're going to find out in a minute, but now we have somebody else introduced. We got Ish-bosheth. He's Saul's son. He's the king. Now we got these two guys introduced, Baanah and Rechav. Now we're going to have somebody else introduced. So it's kind of all setting the stage for these characters. So verse 4 introduces this next character. It says, Jonathan, the son of Saul, had a son who was crippled in his feet. He was 5 years old when the report of Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel, and his nurse took him up and fled. But while she was in a hurry and she was fleeing, he fell and became lame. And his name was Mephibosheth. We're going to hear a lot more about him in the future. Now, the reason he's introduced at this point is because this is the narrator's way of saying there is another male who could theoretically be an heir to the throne of Ish-bosheth. And I say theoretically because Number one, he's the son of Jonathan, and Jonathan had sworn off the kingship. And number two, because he is not able to walk because he's lame in his feet, he's not going to be able to be a commander as the king was expected to be. So even though he's around, he's not going to be the real heir to the throne. And he's also going to become part of the story later on. But I think that's the reason he's introduced here, is to let us know who might or might not be in line for the throne.
And of course, it seems that his nurse, she hears news that Saul is dead and Jonathan's dead. She assumes that, well, there might be a succession, you know, hunt that goes on. And so out of interest for him, I mean, the reason she flees with him is that she's afraid that someone might come and try to kill him.
Yeah. Yeah. And anyone who's looked at any kind of court intrigues over the centuries knows that there's a very high likelihood of something like that happening.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, you have, I mean, it's all over the world when a king dies and you got multiple sons and nephews and a lot of potential heirs to the throne. Very often the guy who gets actually placed on the throne is the one who killed everybody else, right? He might kill his brothers. He might kill kind of the sons of the harem. There's no telling who he might kill to make sure that he just basically eliminates the competition. But anyway, yeah, that's what happened when Saul died. She was fleeing with him and something happened. It must have been a pretty serious injury. Come back to him when he reemerges in the story. Let's get back to these two guys that we heard about earlier, Baanah and Rechab, two brothers. So these guys, they go to the house, this is verse 5, they go to the house of Ish-bosheth in the heat of the day while he was taking his midday rest. You can almost tell, even if you just like stop there, that this is not going to be well. Something about the way this whole story is set up is like, oh, this doesn't sound good.
Yeah, you got a king taking a nap, some dudes coming to visit him. It's not good.
Yeah, not good, not good. Verse 6 is, you can't really tell it in our translations, but if you look in any commentary, they'll point out that there's multiple problems here with the Hebrew as to how we should translate it. We'll just kind of skim over it, and if you want to check that out on your own, feel free to do so. But here's how most translations read. They came into the midst of the house as if to get some wheat, and they stabbed him in the stomach. And then Rechab and Baanah, his brother, escaped. Now, I don't know how the wheat figures into this. Maybe that was just kind of part of the ruse. But anyway, they sneak in. They get to him. And once more, we have a stomach wound. This is what, the third that we've had?
Yeah.
We have Saul. We have the brother of Joab. And then we have Abner, who's stabbed in the belly by Joab. And here now we have Ish-bosheth, who stabbed in the belly. So
I guess they hadn't figured out where the vital organs were at this point or something. There's a lot of stomach stabbing going on.
Yeah, a lot of stomach stabbing going on. So this is number 3 or 4 in that list. And then they, verse 7 picks it up kind of repetitively. It says they came into his house. He was lying on his bed in his bedroom. They strike him, kill him, but they're not done yet. If the belly wounds is a pattern, we also now have another pattern emerging, and that is the removal of his head. So they cut off his head, they take his head, and then they travel by way of the Arabah all night. They're, of course, heading to where King David is at. This is so contrary to everything that we're familiar with, but of course, there's a lot of beheadings in the Bible. And the reason that, one of the reasons anyway, this was often done is because for symbolic purposes, the king is the head of the land. He's not just the symbolic head, he really is the head of the land. And so when you chop off his head, this is a way of basically symbolically removing any power that he has. So you're showing by the very decapitation that the head is gone. There is no more king. There is no more authoritative figure at the top of the body of Israel. So they take his head, and you can almost guess what they're going to want to do, right?
I'll say this. I think that these are two guys that did not get the memo about David's grieving of Abner. It's possible that they're like, David had someone take out Abner. Like, it's on. Like it's going down right now. Now is the time for us to do something great, to get on this, you know, this the good side of the who's going to be the new king. It appears that the throne taking is underway. So let's we think David's going to do this, and so we'll go ahead and make ourselves good in his eyes. This is a massive miscalculation, I think, of what's going on. Now I don't know that that's how this is going, but it seems to me that they did not understand that the death of Abner was not something that David wanted or that David was a part of, and they have really misread the events that have taken place up to this point.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the main reason they do what they do. Another possible reason, and this is kind of a strange part of the story. I don't think we've mentioned it so far in the podcast, but so if you read ahead in 2 Samuel to chapter, I believe it's chapter 21, there is, so this is, of course, way down the line. There's a report of an attack that Saul made on the Gibeonites. And there's some repercussions from that later on. So we're actually never told about this happening. But you remember the Gibeonites were supposed to have a treaty. They had a pact with Israel that they were not to be harmed. But for whatever reason, and again, we're never told about when this happened or why it happened or anything else, but Saul did it. It was a massacre that he engaged in against the Gibeonites. So there's also the possibility that these guys are retaliating for that. Now, we don't know that that is the reason, but that could be also part of their impetus for taking out. They're kind of getting revenge against Saul by killing his son, in other words. But whatever their reasoning, whatever they were prompted by, we do know from verse 8 how they were trying to gain David's favor through this. So they brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron and said to the king, now listen to their language, look, the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy who sought your life. Thus the Lord has given my lord the king vengeance this day on Saul and his descendants.
So yeah, they don't know David at all.
No, they do not know David. massive miscalculation there. Not only have they struck down, I wouldn't call him the Lord's anointed, but anyway, they've struck down the king, but now they have said God has made this happen. So they're bringing the Lord into picture. So they're arguing. Their argument is, we've done a great thing for you, David. We've taken out your enemy, and we've done the Lord's will. It was the Lord's will for us to be able to engage in this cowardly, shameful assassination. I suppose that's their way of interpreting this.
Yeah. So we know that David has ample opportunity to take Saul out in cowardly ways. Now, he won't do it because he won't touch the Lord's anointed, but I don't know that he would do it regardless, because that's not how he operates, right? So he does not think that this is how you are supposed to engage in conflict. It does seem that this sort of cowardly behavior is pretty disgusting to David, which, of course, this all is building to David being the largest coward of all cowards, doing something unimaginably cowardly later on, which shows you just how similar we all are. But I think that that's part of it. They're like, look what we did. And I think that he's not okay with you going and killing the sons of Saul. He doesn't want that. And he's not okay with the way that you did it either. Like, it's a double disgust here. Like, you did a bad thing in a bad way.
Yeah, you know, when I was reading through this particular chapter and thinking about David's response here, I mean, it's not an exact parallel, but, you know, there is something in David's overall approach to taking the throne that is strikingly similar to the approach that the son of David takes as he is gradually working his way toward taking his throne. If you read through the Gospels, Jesus is, you know, he's back and forth to Jerusalem. He's traveling all around. He's teaching. But, you know, a lot of the time, he's actually avoiding the people who are coming after him, right? He's not, like, actively trying to get the Pharisees, the Sadducees, or the chief priest, or whoever to arrest him. He's working his way toward his own throne, the cross. But he's not rushing to Jerusalem and trying to make it happen immediately. He knows that there has to be a time period between his baptism and his crucifixion for him to teach, for him to gather his disciples, for him, for all the things necessary to happen. And that way, it's, I mean, it is parallel to what's happening here with David. He's been anointed as king. He's had his baptism, as it were, but he hasn't taken the throne yet, not over all of Israel. So he's going to let these events transpire that are eventually going to bring him to that throne. But he also has to put up with a lot of junk along the way. Right, he has to put up with people in opposition to him. He has to put up with people engaging in treacherous acts. All of these things have this parallel between David and between Christ and their respective movements toward the throne. Now, what's going to happen to these guys? Well, we find out right after they have this conversation with David.
There has to be a gradual face dropping that happens. As David, because they probably go in there all. I mean, they sound extremely confident. They seem like they're waiting for their, they're waiting for their reward. And David is going to tell them exactly what that reward is. He lets them know, and even uses the word of reward, that I will tell you how I rewarded such people with such news in the past.
Yeah. So this is verse 9. If this were a movie, the movie would like flash between David's face and then their face. And yeah, you'd be able to see that gradual falling apart of probably the smile that they had on their face when they walked up to David. So verse 9 says, David answered Rechab and Baanah's brother, "As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life out of every adversity. When one told me, 'Behold, Saul is dead,' and thought he was bringing good news, so he thought he had some gospel for David, I seized him and killed him at Ziklag, which was the reward I gave him for his news." Now, at this point, these guys, they're not smiling anymore. They're either poker-faced or they're beginning to sweat and shake.
Yeah, because, I mean, this is like, it's almost like they show up being like, hey, I don't know if there's a bounty for this, but we totally killed Saul's kid, and we got his head here. David said, "Well, there is a reward for people who bring me such news. I've established this in the past.
I've got a proven track record for this." So which was the reward I gave him for that news. Verse 11: "How much more, when wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house, on his bed, shall I not now require his blood at your hand and literally burn you up from the earth?" Most translations have something like destroy you, but it's literally, I'm gonna burn you up. I'm gonna ba'ar you from the earth.
Isn't this weird that David says a righteous man?
It is. Yeah. I saw that reviewing this morning, I was like, it's quite a statement. Yeah, he's supposed to say it's righteous.
And you don't know if this is because David believes that he was a man of faith, that he believed in Yahweh, and this is enough to declare him a righteous man. Or even though righteousness does not work in degrees, David could be saying, by comparison, this is a very righteous man. But what you're really, I think, getting at is that he was innocent. Like, you went in there like a bunch of cowards and killed this guy who hadn't really done anything to you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in fact, I mean, they were traitorous because they were part of his army. Yeah. So these soldiers who turned on their own leader, and again, once more, it's just same as Abner. They didn't confront him in battle. They didn't challenge him to a duel. He presumably was asleep.
Well, this is what makes Abner better than like these sorts of guys. Abner could have cut Ilbosheth's head off, brought it to David, said the kingdom's yours, and David probably would have killed him.
Yep.
But Abner knew better than that, because that's not how you're supposed to do that.
Yeah, these guys are just, they're just scoundrels, as he calls them here, wicked men. So the chapter ends this way. It says, then David commanded his young men, and they killed them. But they didn't just kill them. This gets pretty gruesome. They killed them and cut off their hands. And they cut off their feet, and they hanged them beside the pool at Hebron. But they took the head of Ish-bosheth and buried it in the tomb of Abner at Hebron. So a lot of pretty gruesome kind of mutilation of bodies happening here.
And this is also why you can't believe that Joab was able to survive killing Abner, because look at David's track record of people doing that sort of thing. I mean, you always end up dead, and not just dead, but I mean, you're like dismembered and stuff. So yeah, I'm guessing David's sister was in his ear begging him not to kill Joab or something, because by all accounts, Abner's a better dude than Ilbosheth, and David somehow was able to, well, hard on Joab. It's very surprising that this isn't the sort of thing that happened to him.
Yeah, you could kind of see Joab looking on as all this happens, thinking to himself,
yeah.
that could have been me. Could have been me. Well, they you might be wondering, why do they engage in this mutilation? Well, I suppose it's symbolic, almost like the head, which I described earlier, the head of the nation. So the hands, of course, are the hands which bore the weapons by which they shamefully killed Ish-bosheth. And the feet are, of course, the means by which they got into his house. And so this is their way of, this is David's way of making it clear that the very instruments by which they brought this about are now going to be removed from them. So shaming the dead in this way was not unheard of in lots of parts of the Old Testament.
When things like this happen, there's a deterrent element of it as well, right? And so David is making an example. He knows that it's unlikely that there'll be no supporters of Saul left, as he takes the throne and this sort of stuff. And he's letting people know that he's not going to be rewarding people who go out there and find relatives of Saul and kill them and bring them stuff. This is a very deterrent move. So he is saying, don't be out there killing, you know, Saul's brother or Saul's nephew or his sister or whatever, then coming to me thinking that you're going to get something, because this is that you will get something. It'll be this.
This will be your reward. If you're looking for a bounty, then this will be your bounty. Yeah, because David has to know at this point that now that Ish-bosheth is dead and that Abner is dead and that Mephibosheth is unable to be a king because of his physical condition, that everything has really been opened up for him to actually assume headship of the entirety of Israel. And that's what we will see in chapter 5. We're going to get to the coming together, the unification of all the tribes under David. He's going to be anointed. There's going to be a lot that happens in chapter 5. So David's going to be embraced by all the tribes. There's going to be this very odd conquest of Jerusalem, which we'll try and untangle next time. And then he makes this alliance with the Tyrians, the people of Tyre. Of course, they will be the ones who assist in the construction of the temple later on. He's taking more wives and concubines that we'll hear about. We have a list of his sons. And then some more battles with the Philistines. So we're sneaking up on two of the most pivotal chapters in 2 Samuel, where we'll hear about the Ark of the Covenant. And then that chapter that really shines through the whole rest of the Old Testament, 2 Samuel chapter 7, where we have the promise of a son of David to come. So we're on the cusp of some more interesting material, but we're out of time this week.
That's it. Well, we will we'll be back next week and begin talking about all of those things. Chad, I'll see you then.
All right, see you then.